Hello, thank you. I'm excited to be here. My name is Jessica Eckhart, and sorry, I can't do two things at once either. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Northland College in northern Wisconsin. When I did a lot of this research, I was at the University of Utah, so that's why you see a shout-out to the University of Utah. As a environmental health sociologist, I share a lot in common with social epidemiologists, and so I'm excited to be here. This is my first time at an epidemiology conference. Broadly speaking, my research looks at how environmental degradation affects human health, and I have a very upstream approach. So I look at how social conditions affect social inequality, so looking at how racial, ethnic status, gender status, social class status affect an individual's risk of environmental inequality, and then how that's kind of parlayed into certain health aspects. Today I'm going to specifically share with you a project that is looking at how air pollution, specifically endocrine disrupting chemicals, their relationship with obesity. I'll get into the associations a little bit. But today, because this is a new relationship being looked at, I'm going to spend a large time, or I'm going to focus on the theoretical background, and I'm going to talk about what obesogenics is, and then I promise you I'll get into the data and we can kind of geek out on the data together. So to begin with, and I may be preaching to the choir a little bit on this front, but I would like to spend a little time talking about environmental inequality and environmental justice, because it's significantly situated within sociology, and that's my framework. So as many of you know, throughout the last four decades, there's been a lot of research looking at environmental inequality issues. And by and large, what we found is that vulnerable populations, specifically minority communities, so communities of color, and low-income communities, actually do face, in general, higher exposure to environmental hazards, okay? So that looks very different depending on where in the United States you're talking about. It could look like increased or higher concentration and proximity to polluting industries. It could look like higher exposure to air pollution. So by and large, we do know that there are environmental inequalities taking place, and this is particularly salient for human health because there's been strong associations connecting environmental inequality, specific hazards, air pollution, for example, to adverse health outcomes like asthma. So I am particularly interested in how pollution exposure affects obesity prevalence. And as I mentioned, this is a very new field, probably less than a decade old. And so to give you kind of a framework of where I'm coming from, we're going to talk a little bit about obesogenics. So obesogenics is the label of this new field that's looking at the relationship between environmental pollution, environmental toxins, and obesity. And within obesogenics, they're particularly concerned with a particular class of chemicals called endocrine disrupting chemicals. And so that's what my research is pulling on. Here we go. So endocrine disrupting chemicals, when talking about obesogenics, a lot of this research has been done by toxicologists. And the associations that they've found so far is that endocrine disrupting chemicals can actually, once absorbed into the body, can disrupt metabolic processes. Sometimes it can increase the number of fat cells. It can also increase the size of fat cells. So again, this is very new. To give you a visual representation of where this body of literature has been situated thus far, a lot of toxicologists have been looking at how endocrine disrupting chemicals affect many glands in the endocrine disrupting system. So here's a graphic of the endocrine disrupting system. In the blue blocks, you'll see this is where a lot of the research has been focused. It's been focused on reproductive organs and glands and looking at things like sperm count, sperm quality, looking at a particular type of reproductive cancers as well. A growing, and again new, so if you find this topic sexy, there's a lot of ways to expand this research. If you pay particular attention to the metabolic glands of the endocrine disrupting system, which are highlighted in the red, this is where this association may be occurring. So again, the argument among obesogenic scholars is that endocrine disrupting chemicals, and I'll go over particularly what some of those are in just a moment, once absorbed can affect a lot of these glands that affect weight maintenance, systems in the body. So as a sociologist, kind of making the connection between a lot of these different social conditions. Again, I'm looking and particularly concerned at social inequality and how social inequality affects environmental exposure and then how that environmental exposure can affect health. So my particular research questions and objectives for this project, I had two broad questions. The first is, do economically depraved and communities of color actually face higher risks of endocrine disrupting chemicals, specifically airborne endocrine disrupting chemicals? And if so, is there an association between exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and obesity prevalence across the United States? So this is a population level study. So in terms of my methodology, the exposure data comes from the EPA's National Air Toxic Assessment for 2005. In terms of my demographic and health data, so those obesity measures, I used data from the BRFSS, also from the same year, 2005. My sample, again, looking at this at a population level, I had over 188,000 individuals that were spread out over 153 metropolitan statistical areas in all 50 states. In terms of my key variables, my key health variables were obesity, and morbid obesity, and I used BMI as a indicator for those two weight levels. In terms of control variables that might affect obesity, so I'm trying to essentially test for confounding variables, I looked at a lot of things, and because of time, I'm not going to go over these specifically, but age, we do know that obesity and age, there's a curvilinear relationship, so I controlled for that. I also controlled for smoking, physical activity, and other health statuses that have been associated with obesity, such as diabetes. In terms of the exposure variable, I looked at annual concentrations of 7 in endocrine disrupting chemicals, and so here's a list. I apologize for the fine print. Most of these 7 chemicals have been linked to obesity or metabolic processes in the literature, and a lot of them are either insecticides or herbicides, and a couple of them are industrial plasticizers. So again, this is all airborne. So going back to the exposure variables, I looked at annual concentration estimates for each of these. And what's really cool about this project is I could actually parse it out into what's called non-point and point pollution sources, meaning that I could control or specifically look at pollution sources that are stemming from mobile sources. So non-point sources are mobile sources like automobiles, and point sources, so things such as factories that have a set location. In terms of my statistical analysis, I did a multi-level logistic regression. I looked at individuals nested within the metropolitan statistical area. And so I'm going to broadly, for the sake of time, tell you what my major findings were, and then I'll show you some really dense tables. Okay, so just to remind you what my main research question was in the findings I'm going to present today, they're largely based on obesity. So was there an association between airborne endocrine disrupting chemical exposure and obesity prevalence? What I found, at least in this particular study, and this study is the first, to my knowledge, that does a very ecological, large-scale study of this, particularly in the United States, a lot of the associations between endocrine-disrupting chemicals and obesity are being done and conducted in Europe. So I found that air pollution estimates were not actually associated with obesity or morbid obesity in this particular study. What was associated with obesity risk was statuses that probably are not surprising given our obesity knowledge, race and ethnicity. So ethnic and racial minorities had higher risks except Asian Americans. They actually had a lower risk for obesity. And then socioeconomic status, lower socioeconomic status individuals had higher obesity risk as well compared to individuals with higher socioeconomic status. Asian minorities, as I mentioned, they have their own interesting trajectory with weight that I'd be happy to talk to you about in person after for the sake of time. I also stratified these analyses by gender, so I looked at males and females separately, and women essentially racial minority women specifically kind of face a double burden. Their obesity risk is much higher compared to men and compared to whites. So as a sociologist, I find that particularly interesting when thinking about targeted policies for pollution exposure and obesity risk. And then, as I mentioned, socioeconomic status is also positively and significantly associated with obesity. So as I promised, here's my really, really dense table. But what I want you to take note of is at the top are my endocrine-disrupting chemical exposure variables. And as you can see, they're negatively associated, but they're non-significant. And then, as I mentioned, there are different patterns depending on the race and ethnicity and social class. This one's for obesity, and this is for morbid obesity. So again, in the sake of time, I'd be happy to go over the specifics of this later. So in terms of my take-home messages for this project, one thing I wasn't able to show you in the sake of time was my environmental justice question. And when I did another study with the same data, what came out was that there are ethnic and racial predictors for what type of environmental quality an individual experiences, but it's complex. It varies. It depends on the racial and ethnic group. It depends on where in the country they live. It depends on the urban versus rural setting. So environmental justice isn't just a black and white issue. It's very, very complex. And then in terms of the obesogenic hypothesis, this idea that endocrine-disrupting chemical exposure can increase an individual's risk of obesity or morbid obesity, this particular study did not support that hypothesis. But again, this is very, very new. And some things that I would like to do in the future, I think longitudinal studies are crucial in investigating this relationship. I also think that better environmental exposure variables and weight measures are needed as well to really get at what's going on and if there is an association between EDCs and obesity. So in conclusion, I think an interdisciplinary framework and approach is really needed to address this issue, whether it comes from sociology, social epidemiology, epidemiology in general. I think that we should work together to uncover what mechanisms are underscored here. Because I think that there is a lot to be said between environmental exposure and obesity. We just don't know that much about it yet. And then finally, I think a big take-home message for me and probably for a lot of you in this room is the environmental justice component and what we're going to do with this data, and hopefully it would be informed communities. So that's it, and I think it's time for questions for any of the panelists.
Thank you. So first, I'd like to call all of our presenters up here for our question and answer and discussion period. And then for folks that have questions in the audience, please come up to the mic up here and introduce yourselves, your name and your agency. And you guys can use this mic, too, if you want. I know there's a lot.
David Sweat from Shelby County Health Department, Memphis, Tennessee. Thank you for your presentations, all very good. I do have two questions, one for Dr. Ahmed and one for Jonathan. How are you going to find these people that lived there from 1965 to forever, as yours? And then, Jonathan, have you got any access to the total hospital discharge data set for Alaska as opposed to Medicaid claims only?
So that's the first part. And then what they do is they give you updated contact information. So tell me where they live now and give me a phone number if you've got a phone number for them. We pay a company to do that. It's actually fairly reasonable. I mean, it's better than, like, me doing it.
Cool, thanks. As far as hospitalization data goes in Alaska, we do have some hospital discharge data. 10 of the hospitals in Alaska that cover 10 years it's not the most recent of data. Unfortunately, we don't have complete reporting from all of the hospitals in Alaska. So, that is very ripe for analysis as well, and that's something we intend to look into with as we move forward with this analysis.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lyon Callum, a state epidemiologist for Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and I wanted to congratulate you all on cramming, like your presentations were very succinct, and you know, thank you, really great session. I noticed that Kentucky had one last slide that was a multivariate analysis, and I was wondering, can you talk about what the results of that will be?
Sure, so that was, from finding those things that were significant and then finding that they're correlated with age, we also wanted to put them in together to do multivariate. What we found was that age, Hispanic, and the surface soil, again, were all significant when in the same model. Hispanic, so those were the two main ones that we looked at, and then the additional third one in that was Hispanic, self-identifying as Hispanic. There was an interaction between age and Hispanic, but part of that was, I think, largely due to this, the group of Hispanic individuals were very closely knit, and a lot of it was like extended family, and one of their residents was very high in arsenic, so they spent a lot of time there. I think that was also partly due to the surface soil level at that residence. But within Hispanic, it also existed that the younger population had higher levels as well. So, if I had more time, it could probably do half hour more on that. But it just didn't make the earlier slide. So.
Stephanie Yendel from the Minnesota Department of Health. My question's for Brooke. Did you do an educational intervention at some point during your study?
Yes, that was kind of, that was one of the main objectives of that study. So after basically each clinic visit, it was kind of personalized one-on-one education. So after looking at especially the mercury screening questionnaire to know what fish the participant reported eating, then the project coordinator would then go through the advisory guidelines and try to educate them to switch what fish they were eating. So in the hopes that at follow-up, they would change, if they were eating high mercury fish, that they would change their consumption habits.
Any thoughts on why you had more exceedances in the follow-up?
I know, right? We're a little surprised by that. I think part of it was seasonal. So unfortunately, when we started the project, we started in the winter, and this is northern Wisconsin. So I think part of that is people weren't eating as much fish, especially if it was locally caught. So then 6 months, after January, you're in more of the fishing season, and people are out, and I think there was more consumption. And that could have maybe led to just choosing fish, especially walleye. Walleye is really big in that part of our state. So I think that could be part of the reason why.
Hello, I'm Kelly from the North Carolina Department of Health. I have a toenail question. Do you think, I know you mentioned there were, I forget what number, of samples that you couldn't test. Were they, do you think they were kind of random, or do you think there was some sort of systematic association possibly between exposure? Like, for instance, if they were all, like, babies or toddlers and they were too small?
Was a number of children that didn't have, that couldn't get samples from because they just cut their toenails. So
Right. One
of the things that, why it was hard to get it, especially that first time, was the response was so quick. You know, we heard about it Thursday or Friday, and we were out Tuesday the next week. So we had enough time to tell people we were coming out and set up, but not enough time to be like, don't
cut
your toenails, grow it out for like 2 weeks before we come. So.
So if there's like the true association between age, then it could even be like an underestimate. Your results. It was,
you know,
a lot
I haven't,
of children.
I just from some of the interviews I did, I know that it was the a couple kids that we didn't get samples from, but I guess I didn't look into you know, if there was any associations with the people who weren't able to provide a large enough sample. So that'd be really interesting to look at. We can look at that too. So, thanks.
By the Stanford position. I have two sort of related questions having to do with communication of results. And you know, for the arsenic study, I mean, what did you tell the people whose toenail clippings were above your reference? And how did you also message more broadly to the community? So that's the arsenic one. And then for the TCE one, how are you messaging the results of a research study, and especially going on to a bigger research study? How do you message that to the community, and how is that beneficial?
Sure. When we were communicating results, we really tried to, because we were using toenail and it wasn't, you know, a clinically certified test, we tried not to say, like, categorize these results as high or low, because we didn't want to send a message that we didn't have, essentially. So what we said was the baseline and gave them their result. And the first time we sent results back, it was in like a community meeting type thing. So we had people there to help explain what this all meant and kind of walk them through that. Did that answer your question?
So you were saying it's a marker of exposure, but not saying it had anything to do with health risk?
Right. And we didn't, you know, say, we couldn't communicate any specific things like that, I guess.
So for us, we wrote a very kind of detailed report, but I mean, it was like heavy report. There's a big limitation section, and it was, you know, very clear to say that this isn't saying that there is or is not exposure. You know, exposure leads to these health effects that we looked at and set all the limitations of our data and stuff like that. This was actually a big communication fail for us, from my perspective. The reason being, I mean, it was a very scientifically technical document. And the original plan had been, because all along we had really, PDHA had really great interaction in the community. We were down there, we were hooking everyone up to city water, people were happy about that, the response was quick, right? And the original plan had been, after the health study, we go down and do another public meeting and give the interpretation and talk in normal people terms about what that meant. And we were supposed to have good news, because there's supposed to be a community-wide remediation was supposed to happen to get all of the contaminated, there's contaminated soil as well, and other remediation that was supposed to happen. Funding was not there for the remediation activities, and so that public meeting did not happen. So our study, you know, everyone got a copy of the study, but it was a big communication fail. What we are doing now is, for the second phase where we're working with KU and Boston University, is it is going to be community-based participatory research. So it's actually a really interesting way of improving an FE study design. So we've got a steering committee of people that live in that area that are going to have and have already started having input on what they want to see come out of the study and how do we want results, you know, back to us. Okay, we are going to encourage our neighbors to participate in your study because now we understand what a response rate means in the long run. So I think that if it happens, it all depends on if you get funding for it. If it happens, that it will be a really strong study design. And it's a first for me. I've never done an EPI study with that community-based, participatory research aspect. I think it's me.
This is for Washington. So has the state-owned hospital developed like a water management plan, and did it have any impact on other state-owned facilities that might be high-risk?
So part of this, yes, they are working on a Legionella, like a water management plan. And one of the things we figured out during this process is that we had 7 state-run hospitals that were on untreated water, and that 6 of them had connections to city water. And it was just a matter of water is expensive, especially at the volumes used by hospitals, and they didn't want to switch over. And so this started a process of like looking at all those systems and trying to get them to consider their options going forward and try and communicate to them the risk of not doing it. So that's been part of the results of that.
Great. Well, we are at 3:30, so I want to thank everyone for attending, and please welcome me in thanking all of our presenters.